Pusa gives us a destroyed Jerusalem in the foreground with dead Jews in the background. But the Jews, as a people, did continue to live after the fall of Jerusalem. And whether in the ghetto in Rome or elsewhere around the world, they continue to remember Jerusalem and to long to return to Jerusalem. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, Episode 93, The Temple Burns. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Around the year 1625, the French master Nicolas Pusa, painting in Rome, created a depiction of the destruction of the temple at Jerusalem by the Roman general Titus. The work had been commissioned by a nephew of the Pope, Cardinal Barberini, who bestowed the painting to Cardinal Richelieu in Paris as a gift. The painting depicted a temple in flames with Romans slaughtering the Jews who lie largely dead upon the sanctuary space. In the painting, we see Titus himself, who in Poussin's presentation is attempting to prevent the sanctuary from being set aflame. This, as we shall see, was based on Josephus' version of events, which is not the only one. And the painting was sent to Richelieu as a plea that he seek to prevent war. But soon after it was created, the painting disappeared for hundreds of years. And its story helps us reflect on the event that it depicts, the destruction of the temple, and also on the Jewish response to this event, a response that the painting itself overlooks. In Jewish tradition, the 9th and the 10th days of the month of Av are marked as dates on which the Romans stormed the temple, the edifice went up in flames, and was ultimately entirely destroyed. That is why, till now, traditional Jews fast on the 9th of Av and continue aspects of their mourning till noon on the 10th. We turn now to the events of those days. As we have seen, Titus demolished the Antonia Fortress and created an enormous embankment leading up to the northern side of the temple. As depicted helpfully in the book A Temple in Flames, several other embankments were added in the 3 weeks that followed. And, according to Josephus' account, on the 9th of Av, sensing that his forces would succeed in breaching the temple walls, Titus held a council with his military leaders to discuss what the fate of the temple should be. According to Josephus, Titus decided that the temple should not be destroyed. Here is what he writes, quote, Titus proposed to these that they should give him their advice, what should be done about the Holy House. Now some of these thought it would be the best way to act according to the rules of war and demolish it, because the Jews would never leave off rebelling while that house was standing, at which house it was that they used to get all together. Others of them were of opinion that in case the Jews would leave it and none of them would lay their arms up in it, he might save it, but that in case they got upon it and fought any more, he might burn it, because it must then be looked upon not as a holy house but as a citadel, and that the impiety of burning it would then belong to those that forced this to be done and not to them. But Titus said that, although the Jews should get upon that holy house and fight us thence, yet ought we not to revenge ourselves on things that are inanimate, instead of the men themselves, and that he was not in any case for burning down so vast a work as that was, because this would be a mischief to the Romans themselves, as it would be an ornament to their government while it continued. This is Josephus's version, who then describes how the assault on the Temple Mount began. And then, he writes, at a certain point, someone set a fire alight, which consumed the temple. Josephus continues. At this point, one of the soldiers, awaiting no orders and with no horror of so dread a deed, but moved by some supernatural impulse, snatched a brand from the burning timber and, hoisted up by one of his comrades, flung the fiery missile through a low golden door, which gave access on the north side to the chambers surrounding the sanctuary. As the flame shot up, a cry, as poignant as the tragedy, arose from the Jews, who flocked to the rescue, lost to all thought of self-preservation, all husbanding of strength, now that the object of all their past vigilance was vanishing. Titus was resting in his tent after the engagement when a messenger rushed in with the tidings. Starting up just as he was, he ran to the temple to arrest the conflagration. Behind him followed his whole staff of generals, while in their train came the excited legionaries, and there was all the hubbub and confusion attending the disorderly movement of so large a force. Caesar, both by voice and hand, signaled to the combatants to extinguish the fire, but they neither heard his shouts, drowned in the louder din which filled their ears, nor heeded his beckoning hand, distracted as they were by the fight or their fury. The impetuosity of the legionaries, when they joined the fray, neither exhortation nor threat could restrain. Passion was for all the only leader. Crushed together about the entrances, many were trampled down by their companions, Many, stumbling on the still hot and smoldering ruins of the porticos, suffered the fate of the vanquished. As they drew nearer to the sanctuary, they pretended not even to hear Caesar's orders and shouted to those in front of them to throw in the firebrands. The insurgents, for their part, were now powerless to help, and on all sides was carnage and flight. End quote. This, according to Josephus, is how the temple was set aflame, by the Roman soldiers themselves, with Titus attempting to stop them. And it is from Josephus that Pusa derived his version of events as depicted in the painting. But as historians note, there is another version of the story from Josephus' contemporary Tacitus, which is cited by the later Roman historian Sulpicius Severus, who gives us a very different account. Here is one translation. Quote, Titus summoned his council and before taking action consulted it whether he should overthrow a sanctuary of such workmanship, since it seemed to many that a sacred building, one more remarkable than any other human work, should not be destroyed. For if preserved, it would testify to the moderation of the Romans, while if demolished, it would be a perpetual sign of cruelty. On the other hand, others and Titus himself expressed their opinion that the temple should be destroyed without delay, in order that the religion of the Jews and Christians should be more completely exterminated. End quote. This is another historian's version in a translation found in the book Roman Jerusalem. Thus did the temple go up in flames, a moment marked and mourned by Jews for generations. And in a striking way, the mourning meant that the temple would be remembered. If we wish to appreciate this, we need only look to the later 20th century tale of Poussin's painting, which, as I described in Mosaic, begins with an eccentric Englishman by the name of Ernest Onions, a British farmer and multimillionaire who made his fortune during World War II by inventing what is known in England as totten pudding, a form of pig swill made from waste food. Having amassed a large amount of money, he decided to become an art collector, traveling all over the country, purchasing portraits at fairs and garage sales, amassing some 500 works in all. Upon his passing in the 1990s, his heirs instructed Sotheby's to take the whole lot of their eccentric uncle's art and sell it. The auction house turned out a catalog of the paintings, and one image in that catalog caught the eye of art historian Sir Dennis Mann. He saw in the catalog a small image of a destruction of an ancient city. The painting had been identified by Sotheby's as The Sack of Carthage by the artist Pietro Testa and listed at a suggested price of £15,000. Sir Dennis Mann, looking carefully at the catalog, realized that the title had been misattributed, perhaps, as by Sachs and others have written, because among the loot being carried away by the plundering soldiers in the painting was a menorah, which meant that this was not Carthage. And I'm very indebted to Rabbi Sachs for his reflections on this story. Sir Dennis Mann instructed the auction house for which he worked, Hazlitt's, to purchase the painting, and it did so for £150,000. His hunch proved correct. His intuition clued him into one of the greatest art discoveries of the century, a Pusa that had been lost for 300 years and was worth tens of millions of dollars. Why did the artistic experts at Sotheby's miss what Sir Dennis Mann was able to decipher? The answer lies in the choices made by Pusa in depicting the scene. First, the temple itself looks nothing like it actually did. Pusa portrayed the temple as a duplicate of the Pantheon, and as we will see tomorrow, this was a common mistake in depicting the destruction. Moreover, the main characters in this painting are not Jews but Romans. Oddly, very few Jews are to be found in this city that is the locus of Jewish longing and spiritual aspiration, and those that there are essentially dead. For most art historians, the discovery of a Pusa was a source of delight, but as Rabbi Sachs noted at a celebration of the find at the National Gallery, one cannot help but be struck by how Pusa gives us, in Rabbi Sachs's words, a Jewish tragedy almost without Jews. Of course, had Pusa checked with the Jews in the city where he painted, in Rome, they could have guided his own choices about how this event was depicted. Where were the Jews of Pusa's Rome? Rabbi Sachs again provided the answer. He said, quote, the short answer is, hidden behind the walls of the ghetto, the position of Jews in Rome, once relatively benign, worsened dramatically during the Counter-Reformation, and we still carry traces of this in our language. If Germany gave the world the phrase final solution, and Russia the word pogrom, 16th century Italy gave us the word ghetto, born in Venice and extended throughout the Papal States. End quote. Pusa gives us a destroyed Jerusalem in the foreground, with dead Jews in the background. But the Jews, as a people, did continue to live after the fall of Jerusalem. And, whether in the ghetto in Rome or elsewhere around the world, they continue to remember Jerusalem and to long to return to Jerusalem. If we seek to see an embodiment of this longing, all we need to do is find out where Pusa's painting hangs today. When the news of Sir Dennis Mann's discovery of the Pusa was announced, the British government sought to prevent the painting from being taken out of the country, but it was too late. because the Rothschild Foundation had purchased the painting from Hazlitt's and donated the work to the Israel Museum, giving the institution the first Pusa in its collection. Thus, strikingly, the painting that portrays the destruction of Jerusalem is on display in a rebuilt Jerusalem, and an artist's depiction of a destruction of a people is belied by where the painting hangs today. Pusa, of course, could never have predicted this, nor, I would guess, could Cardinal Barberini or Cardinal Richelieu. But Jews themselves could have, whether in 70 CE or 1625, because when asked where they would be in the year to come, they would have all answered with hope, next year in Jerusalem. 93 episodes into our story, ladies and gentlemen, we have reached the cataclysmic event in Jerusalem's history. And we must remember it through this image, through this painting by Pusa, because it also reminds us of the miracles of our time, as well as what the temple meant to Jews, and why there is still so much for which to yearn. This is Meir Soloveitchik, wishing you a Shabbat Shalom and looking forward to learning together next week. Signing off.